Blog Talk Radio.
Live to see it, friends. You're listening to Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. Fast Forward Radio is an audio production of The Speculist, and you can find us online at speculist.com. That's S-P-E-C-U-L-I-S-T.com. Or go straight to the blog at blog.speculist.com. At The Speculist and on Fast Forward Radio, we are all about a convergence of emerging technologies and emerging possibilities, which lies at the heart of this, the greatest period of transformation in human history. Our world is changing in ways that are hard to predict, sometimes even hard to imagine. And Fast Forward Radio is your guide to an astounding future that lies ahead and that will be here sooner than you think. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio is my co-blogger, co-futurist, and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, Phil. How are you?
I am super fantastic. How are you doing, my friend?
Oh, I'm doing great. Just trying to figure out what the recovery is going to look like when it comes, the economic recovery. So,
well, you know, as I was going through my spiel about convergence of emerging technologies and so forth, and unexpected and sometimes, hard to imagine, I wouldn't have guessed more than a month ago, I think almost 2 months ago, when we started talking about the new economy, that topic would have such legs with us.
Yeah.
We've always sort of, it's been an interesting topic from time to time over the last 2.5 years, but it really seems to have gotten a hold of us, both of us, in a pretty serious way here.
Yeah, I mean, it's something that, well, for one thing, there's some pessimism involved in this. You know, we're talking about, jobs basically in number, at least, leaving and never coming back, certain industries, and being replaced by maybe new and exciting industries, but that don't employ nearly as many people. And so, there's a certain amount of pessimism there, and we as natural optimists don't gravitate towards those issues. But we found the ideas of Martin Ford and to some extent Cory Doctorow in his novels. We found these ideas compelling, and so we kind of got into these in a major way, haven't we?
I think so. I think that that those two guests really got our attention and really got us thinking about these things. And I think the other thing that's happened is history has intervened on behalf of this topic, in terms of just kind of keeping it in front of us. It's hard to read the headlines without seeing something that doesn't, seem at least marginally related to this, and I've noticed that you've had a couple of blog posts over the past week touching on this subject, and I had a couple of things I intended to write that we never got onto the blog that we'll talk about tonight, all of which have to do with this, I think, very critical question as to whether the nature of our economy is changing. And I think that there are definitely indicators, there is definitely evidence to suggest that that's exactly what's happening. It's something that we've speculated about in our role as speculists over the last few years, but to witness it happening, potentially, is an exciting, not necessarily in a good way, because as you said, that's a terrible thing to have happen, is for jobs to go away and not come back, and people to be left wondering what to do next. But it's intriguing, I guess. I'm trying to think of the right word. It's exciting. It's got that train wreck, you can't look away kind of attraction to it that I think we have to spend some more time on it. But I'll tell you the other thing that I think we need to do, and that is we need to put in context how certain we can be that we're reading the signs correctly. Because one of the points that I always try to make about putting together a coherent scenario or a coherent picture of the future is that you want to have multiple scenarios. You want to have more than one possible ways that the current trends could possibly work out. One of the things that really irks me actually is when people talk about certain things being foregone conclusions or talking like something is inevitable. Very few things are actually truly inevitable, and even when we see things happening that appear to be falling right into line with a coherent picture of the future that someone's put together, such as Corey did in his book Makers, which we'll get into here in just a minute, not always necessarily the way things end up going. Things actually can go any number of ways, and that's why tonight's show is called The Signs of the Times. We're going to look at those signs of the times around the economy, and then we'll look at a few others and see what we can say for sure about the future, and maybe what we can say with a certain amount of humility and uncertainty about the future.
Yes, the future, always in motion, it is.
So, hey, away with you. Away, put your weapon. I mean you no harm.
That's exactly right. these are nothing new. Sally in the chat room just wrote that she read a reposting of a 1961 Time magazine article on the fear of losing jobs to automation. And so, you know, I mean, forever people have been concerning themselves with these topics. So, but, you know, and we've ourselves a certain automation. You know, I mean, we all use ATMs now, and we all, you know, many of us will order our tickets when we go to the movie with our cell phones or whatever, and then just go up and print them out as if, you know, as if it were money from an ATM right at the theater.
Right.
Nowadays
you can print out your boarding pass for,
exactly.
You know, or like go to the baseball game. I actually print out my tickets at home.
Yeah.
So bizarre.
You know, who is a travel agent anymore? You know, I mean,
right.
That industry has basically been destroyed, and AI is, you know, AI is the culprit, you know.
I'm guessing there are some rich people who still have travel agents. That's my guess.
Yeah. Basically it's a souped-up concierge, I guess, for those.
Yeah, exactly.
Those
yeah. Ones.
But, but for the rest of us, we just, go on Expedia or whatever and figure it out for ourselves. And there are many, many jobs that have been affected. And, it's interesting. Once the automation has already happened, and it's a part of our lives, we don't think about it anymore, do we? It's not
right.
The fact that that job no longer exists barely crosses our minds as we're appreciating the efficiency of the new system. So, you know, I suppose it'll be that way with future automation as well.
It will be. You know, when they've automated the jobs of the marketing guys and the lawyers. People will think, oh, yeah, remember they used to have guys do that stuff.
Exactly.
But, fortunately, they'll still need futurists, right? They won't be automating that job. That'll be the last to go. That's why we've gotten into this, actually. It's job security. And I guarantee you, Stephen, that 100 years from now, we will still be making at least as much doing this as we are today.
Exactly. Maybe
at
so.
Least. At least as much. In fact, I think you might be making 10,000 times as much as you're currently making.
Exactly, 10,000 times.
But that's me. I'm an optimist. You know what am I going to say?
I carry the one. Anyway,
let's talk about the signs of the times related to the economy. You've done a couple of pieces on this over the last few days. Catch us up. What's the latest on this?
Okay, I'm going to leapfrog right over the zero G dog.
I forgot about Zero G Dog. By the way, that's a great video. If you haven't, anyone listening, if you haven't seen Zero G Dog yet, check out the Zero G Dog for sure.
So I'll skip over that and go directly to the post on automated unemployment. And I'm envisioning within that blog post a McDonald's or Burger King or, you know, pick your franchise of choice. And imagine it as being completely roboticized. I mean, you know, you might have one human walking through there monitoring the machines, and you know, you order basically through what you know, down to the number of ketchup packets you want, and it's all put together for you, and maybe handed to you by the manager of the McDonald's with a smile on his face, machine that's right behind him that assembles it all for you. To me, that, I mean, it's a compelling vision because it seems so obvious. It would be, you know, the technology required for putting that together is our, it could be done. You could do that with the technology that's available right now. It's just a matter of getting the systems together and putting down the money to develop it. And if you're McDonald's, you look at a company like Google, which I learned produces about $1 million in revenue for its company per employee. And if you're McDonald's and the amount of revenue that you're producing per employee is significantly less, and you want to be a little bit more like Google, then why wouldn't you put down the money to the R&D money necessary to develop that kind of technology? How hard would it be, and how quickly could you implement it? I'm telling you, it could be implemented within a couple of years if somebody put the gas on it, and they could, and that could become incredibly profitable by comparison to their competition. You know, McDonald's or Burger King or whoever decides to do it, provided there's not some sort of Luddite backlash again, and people avoiding those restaurants because they see that there's no people in them. Provided you didn't have that problem, it could be incredibly profitable.
It's interesting to consider when will that backlash begin, if it is going to begin around those kinds of things, because I don't know about the supermarkets in Shreveport. In Denver metro area, every supermarket has a self-checkout lane. Of the standard regular supermarkets. Actually, if I go to Whole Foods, they don't do that. But you think about that. Whole Foods, naturally, they'd be a little more Luddite, right? Wouldn't they? But if you go to Sam's Club or a big place like that, they don't either. But just a normal Safeway or Kroger type supermarket all have the option of checking yourself out, and I almost always do that if I possibly can, unless it's the big weekly trip. And that's too many items to go through the self-checkout. But the question I keep asking is, when are they going to have more than four registers? Because it's been four registers for quite a while now, almost 10 years that it's been four registers.
Yeah.
And when will they let you...
Four registers that are automated?
Yeah.
Okay.
So I think... excuse me. No, it went from four to six a couple of years ago, come to think of it. That's right. When will it be more than six? It's still two aisles, right? It was it's like two rows of them, two on each side, and then they added two more on each side, so there's a total of six. But that's always the most popular place to go. Everybody wants to self-checkout for whatever reason. I don't know if it's aversion to dealing with the checker, or people just feel like it's more efficient if they do it themselves. But it's definitely a popular model for doing it. But I don't see additional checkout aisle space being dedicated to it yet, and I wonder if the thing slowing it down, because obviously the proof of concept is well established here that it will work. There's some reason why they're not adding more, and maybe the reason is that it's aversion to this backlash against it, and maybe that's why McDonald's doesn't do what you're suggesting. Although another possibility why McDonald's doesn't do what you're suggesting is that it would be a substantial monetary outlay initially. I think you make a good point that it would pay off in the long run, and it would pay off handsomely in the long run to do it. But the interesting thing about corporate America is there's not an awful lot of management to the long run that goes on. Most management is done to the quarter. So it's hard to implement these far-reaching automation projects if there's going to be a large capital investment involved. Because every quarter you want the quarter to look good, any quarter or any year where you put in this huge capital investment, that year is not going to look good. That's going to impact the share price. The stockholders are going to be unhappy. There's all these impacts, actually kind of potentially negative impacts to being very research based and future based, which is probably another important difference between a company like Google and a company like McDonald's, because virtually, I'm sure, 90% of what goes on inside the Google campus is, you know, research-based and futures-based and thinking about what the next big step forward might be.
Yeah, and McDonald's, I mean, R&D for them is, you know, has long been, you know, when's the best time to re-release the McRib? You know, I mean, it's, you know, and I say that partly in jest, but you know what I mean. It's they have a certain model. It's worked so it worked very well for a long time. So maybe it won't be McDonald's that tries it. Maybe it'll be one of, you know, maybe it'll be some upstart company, you know, that decides that we're going to make inroads by being more profitable per franchise by laying out the R&D. You know, I don't know.
Yeah, absolutely. Somebody like you know, an also-ran, A&W or, you know.
Carl's. Or,
Carl's Jr., Jack in the Box, somebody like that.
Yeah.
They do it. And if they do it, the technology becomes a lot cheaper. And then suddenly McDonald's, when they get into a cost-saving mode, some genius is going to go, wait, we can save billions. We'll cut all this staff and put in we'll put in fully automated restaurants, which, again,
yeah.
according to that source on Facebook, has been at least a vision of McDonald's for some time, is to have fully automated restaurants. So it's
right.
Not out of the question.
Well, there, you know, and I showed the video as part of the blog post of the location in Germany with the ATM-styled food ordering system. Now, you know, in the back, I presume in the food, good old-fashioned way. It eliminates the cashier. You use a credit card to pay for your food. You order it ATM style, and then use your credit card, and then you just go up and get your food at the front. So, I also envision just losing the ATM as well. An app on your iPhone could serve as the order point. Whatever, you know, it's I see that could happen pretty easily and pretty quickly. But then the technology to produce the food in the back, that could be automated as well. We'll see.
Absolutely could. Okay, so take us to your next piece that you did just yesterday, I believe.
Yeah, it's Forbes weighs in on job loss via automation, and I was struck with how close it was to the idea that I was presenting in the former. Here's the quote. Many dismiss this rather pessimistic view that automation will lead to widespread unemployment by pointing to the fact that while technology eliminates jobs, it also creates new industries and employment sectors. You know, I'm just a second, Phil, because it's an argument I made. This argument glosses over the fact that new technology-based industries tend to be capital intensive. They do not employ large numbers of people. Compare McDonald's to Google. In 2008, McDonald's employed 4,000 people with a revenue of $59,000 per worker, which I think is pretty impressive, right? $59,000 per worker. I wish I got that kind of profit out of the people in my office. But anyway, now happen to be listening. You know, y'all are doing pretty great. But
yeah, you're awesome. He didn't mean anything.
Yeah. Google has just 20,000 people with a revenue, each of which brought in, on average, $1 million in revenue. The question we have to ask is what happens when McDonald's begins to look more like Google, when they want to be more like Google and they start automating? That's, you know, there's going to be widespread unemployment, at least for those jobs.
Okay, well, they, you know what? One thing is McDonald's can look a little more like Google, but the margins are always going to be against McDonald's on this, right? I mean, even if they're fully automated, they're still going to have meat, and you know what I'm saying? It's
yeah,
like
yeah, exactly.
They got to sell stuff.
But,
yeah.
Yeah.
Google, it's all digital, right? I mean, the whole thing is electrons, for crying out loud, sitting in servers. I think McDonald's definitely can drive that number way up in amount of revenue per employee, but they're never going to hit the Google. I hope they're not trying to get to the Google level. The only way that, you know, where they could do that would be in Second Life.
Well, anyway, you know what's funny about this little blurb I just quoted you. The author of that blurb is Martin Ford.
Uh-huh.
And when he said many would dismiss this rather pessimistic view by pointing to the fact that while technology eliminates jobs, it also creates new industry employment sectors, I think I said exactly those words to him in our interview and when he was on Fast Forward Radio. So I think in this instance, I might be many. But I guess I'm just tooting my own horn there.
Well, there you go. You're inspiring Martin to go and write for Forbes. So, or as Sally, I believe, pointed out in the comments, we're basically providing fodder with this program for Wall Street Journal and other major publications. You know, we do what we can to feed the beast.
Keep the conversation rolling. Yes.
Yeah, we get it going, and then others pick it up, and that's kind of what we're all about here. So that's, you know, that is very interesting. It does seem that the headlines have been backing Martin up, and it does seem that the more you look at it, the more lights in the tunnel like our economy appears to be. We really seem to be heading in that direction. And for those listening who have not yet listened to our interview with Martin Ford, The Lights in the Tunnel is the title of his book. It's an analogy he makes about the dependence of our economy on consumer behavior, that basically we have a mass market consumer-driven economy, and he uses an analogy of lights in a tunnel. Each light shining in the tunnel is representative of one kind of unit of consumption, and we have to have a certain number of those to keep the economy alive. And we have to have a lot of them in order to keep the economy viable. And his worry is that if automation really is eliminating jobs, that the income that those jobs produce is what powers the consumption that makes our mass market economy work, what's going to happen? Now, he proposes potential solutions to that. We won't get into those this evening. But for those listening, go back and listen to those programs, or we've talked about it extensively on the blog as well. I think it's more interesting just to note that it's happening, and that we indeed might be going into this what you and I, Stephen, have described as kind of an awkward transition between a market scarcity based economy. That's the term I would use, between a scarcity based economy and an economy of virtually unlimited abundance, which is at the other end of.
I mean, we all love the abundance, don't we?
Yeah.
It's just, how many of us will be able to contribute to to this world of abundance, so that we can then, in turn, have the abundance. I guess in a world that's abundant enough, if the world is rich enough, you don't have to contribute much to get a lot. You could be basically has very little income, and yet you're able to afford fantastic things in the world that we're thinking about. Because, again, there might not be that much money around. I mean, it's sort of a weird version of the Depression that we're considering that not a lot of money, and lots of stuff, which is It's a different world with a wholly different equilibrium between the producers and the consumers, what we are used to and what we've seen. So,
absolutely. And one of the, I think, best descriptions of an awkward transition has to be our other guest that we had on the week. We talked to him the same week as Martin Ford, but I believe his show aired the following week, and that would be Cory Doctorow. Discussing his novel Makers, which really describes a world going through an awkward transition, exactly the kind we're talking about, where automation has provided a tremendous amount of abundance. And some of the themes you just mentioned, Stephen, are huge in that book. The idea of people not having a lot, but being able to get a lot more out of a little than you were able to in the past. And I couldn't help but be reminded of Corey's novel when I was reading this piece by Victor Davis Hanson in Pajamas Media over the weekend.
Right.
He wrote an essay called A Tour Through Recession America. And actually, it's just Recession California, as far as I can tell, unless he's doing multiple parts. But we'll let California be representative enough of America for our purposes. And Victor gets on his bike and he tours around California rural parts and urban parts, and he is not too pleased with what he's seeing. He notes that it's not quite the Great Depression, but there are definitely problems. One problem he notes: rampant obesity across all age and class lines. And he says, if anything, the wealthier in Palo Alto and Stanford eat less. And he says, yes, I know the liberal critique that they have capital and education to shop for expensive, healthier fruits and vegetables, while the poor and neglected must turn to fast food, Coke, and Pop-Tarts. Actually, that was one of the interesting things in Corey's novel. It wasn't just the underclass that were suffering from obesity in that novel. I think that the geek culture gets heavily hit by obesity, as described in Corey's novel. And I think there's a certain amount of truth to that, just because the traditional nerd was not necessarily an athletic type, ate a lot of junk food, and eventually that tends to catch up with you. So there's one interesting little parallel between what Victor Davis Hanson observes in California today and what Corey talks about in his science fiction novel. Now, here's another piece that caught my attention. He says, for a recession, there are lots of Mercedes, BMWs, Lexuses, and Volvos around, and in places like Fresno, too. Fresno was listed as kind of a middle-of-the-road place, somewhere between Palo Alto and the sticks out there in California. Maybe these are just leases, renters who prefer to lease a big car than buy houses, but for Depression-era times, our contemporary versions of the Packard or Pierce Arrow are pretty ubiquitous. And he says, note, I still can't see how a Mercedes or Lexus warrants the far higher price over, say, a Camry or a Accord that seem as comfortable and reliable. 30 years ago, one saw an upscale car on the Stanford campus. Today, you see them on American high school campus. Now, I think that for Victor Davis Hanson, that is a symptom of a sort of a cultural decadence. He's kind of painting this overall picture and not liking what he sees. But I'll tell you, when I look at that one, I say, wow, really? 30 years ago, you didn't see these upscale, you would only see these upscale cars on the Stanford campus, indicating, obviously, the upper crust of society. Now you'll see them out on a high school campus. What does that tell you, Stephen? Actually, I'll phrase it as a question.
I don't see that as a bad thing. To me, wealth is a good thing.
Yeah. You know, it says to me that luxury cars are far more affordable to the main population than they were a few decades ago. And I can't, my brain can't make that into a bad thing, no matter how I try to work that around. Because for one thing, it means maybe I'll get one, right? I can't help but look at it that way.
Yeah, my 1997 Ford Explorer still gets me around, and that's great. But if somebody wants to spend, a lot of money for a luxury car, more power to them.
To his point, I guess it's about status. I don't see how a Mercedes or Lexus warrants the far higher price over a Camry. Well, it doesn't if all you want is transportation. I'm driving a 5-year-old Subaru, which I hope will last another 15 years, and I'll be fine with that because I like to reliably push the pedal and have the car move.
Go.
But there are other considerations when people buy cars, and if luxury cars have been democratized, it seems to me that speaks to an overall increase in general material well-being, or at least availability of goods. And in Makers, in Corey's novel, there's just this wonderful ability to just take things that have been discarded and make them into something useful, something cool, something that you could even sell. These guys take, essentially refuse and make wonderful works of art out of them, the computers and this great thing with these discarded Elmo toys that's described in the book.
I mean, these are Elmo, these Generation 10 Tickle Me Elmos driving this car around. They're networked together, so a couple of those are controlling the pedals, and other Elmos are controlling the steering wheel of this VW, I think, if I remember correctly.
It was some kind of smart car. In fact, one of the things that was interesting about that was it wasn't just the Elmos that were junk that someone had just given to these guys because they needed to get them off their hands. The car itself was junk. So you know, you could build this robots driving a car kinetic sculpture, and the whole thing was built out of leftover used parts. If as things that would have been viewed as valuable a few years ago become leftover used parts at the bottom of the economy, one of the things you would look for to say, is this an overall trend, is, well, are the really valuable, expensive things becoming more affordable to the main body of the economy? And it's like, huh, well, according to Victor Davis Hanson, yeah, they are. And he talks about his own experience, you know, saving up a couple months to buy himself a black and white TV back in the early 70s, and now everyone, no matter how poor they are, has a, you know, he says 52-inch plasma TV. But even if that's a bit of an exaggeration, I think, you know, it's true that something that would have been considered a luxury item, a widescreen TV, 20 years ago, maybe even 10 years ago, is just a very ubiquitously owned piece of property these days. Or think about a mobile phone. I remember when those were luxury items. And
Gordon Gekko.
And there you go, Gordon Gekko, yeah. Well, they had to be luxury items back in those days. Those were big, bulky, heavy things. So, you know, you didn't want to mess around with those. Now, here's the next passage from Victor's piece, and this one really drives it home for me. He talks about something he calls reversion. And he says, there are areas of rural California that are reverting. By that, I mean old statutes no longer apply. On one stretch of road nearby, there are suddenly three new restaurants. And he puts the word restaurants in squares. I can never say scare quotes. I always want to say square quotes. Scare quotes.
You got it.
Yes. By this, I mean so-called mobile hot kitchen vans serving Mexican food have anchored, plopped down roots and driveways, and added awnings, some benches and lights. Presto, the owner seemed to have avoided all the once-feared California regulations concerning proper restroom facilities, sanitation, building codes, and reported taxes. I infer all that since these permanent establishments suddenly disappear and reappear rooted to new locations, apparently if cited or investigated. Now, okay, for one thing, for a conservative, you know, I would expect Victor Davis Hanson to be a little more in favor of this than he seems to be. You know,
well,
to me,
well,
this
he's a conservative, but he obviously he is not as libertarian as some. And
that's an important distinction. Yeah.
He's you know, a libertarian looks at that and smiles. You know, people getting around a regulation is a good thing. Freedom is a good thing, and you know, so that's so the tinkerers that were considering in their garage making Elmos drive cars. That's cool. But also the ability to just you know, hey, I want to start a restaurant. You want to start a restaurant? Let's do it. We can have it open next week.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
You know,
I mean, the fact that there are hungry people who need food. There are these people who have time on their hands who can make food and who need to make a living, and that those two things get to meet in the middle in spite of a once-feared regulatory environment, you know, does not bother me at all. I look at that and I go, yeah, that seems like a fairly good thing. Obviously, there are good reasons why we have a health code and sanitation code, and you don't want people, you know, getting food that that's tainted or, you know, running any of those kinds of risks. But I can't help but think about, when I read that, the shantytown that Cory Doctorow talks about in Makers. Part of the novel, as he's describing an economy which truly is in the throes of massive unemployment brought about by economic growth that continues without the need for human labor. Suddenly, because of the abundance of leftover stuff, people are able to make their own community and make it very nice. One of the things about the shantytown as described in Makers is it's not only serving the function of providing housing to these people and giving them, you know, the opportunity to live a dignified life, but it's a very cool place. Not only because
very
the people
vibrant,
who...
lots of creativity going on. And,
exactly, yeah. Not only because the people living there are vibrant and creative and they're trying to make a better life for themselves, but also because in this case they happen to be next door neighbors to these two like geek wizards who are, you know, just geniuses at figuring out how to solve technical problems. But that's the kind of driving spirit, I think, that says we're going to make something good happen in the face of the fact that there's no jobs anymore. we've got a lot of stuff around, but there's not a job. Therefore, I'm going to take this trailer and take this driveway, and I'm going to make a restaurant out of it.
I'm reminded of the guy. This is a story I heard being down here in Louisiana, being close to what was going on with Katrina. I mean, this guy. I mean, he had meat in his freezer that was going to go bad. I mean, and apparently it was a whole lot of hamburger meat, and he got out there with a grill and he got his hands on a fairly unlimited supply of charcoal. And started grilling burgers and selling them for like $5 each. And, I mean, it became like a happening place, like that right on the side of the road, you know. I mean, where workers that were trying to, help the city out and coming in would buy his burgers and everything else. So that's sort of a impromptu kind of deal. And it happens, that sort of thing happens on the margins of civilization where, you know, I mean, in a very real way, the civilization in New Orleans came to an abrupt end, and you saw all kinds of negative things associated with that. But I thought that was a pretty interesting positive thing. He just basically started the hamburger business.
That is very cool. You know, I mean,
yep.
You look for those signs of ingenuity and just the human drive to improve circumstances. That's basically what drives, I think, the law of accelerating returns and so many of the things we talk about here. Great point from Sally in the chat room. Now I've scrolled and I've lost the chat room, but she's talking about, she says, I do know that landfills are now being mined for valuable metals and other materials. What about when everything in the landfill becomes valuable? And that, I think, Sally, when that happens, we're on the far side of a difficult transition. Because I think when the technology is such that everything that's in a landfill would be of value to someone because we can start making stuff out of it, we're probably well on our way to a full non-scarcity-based but full abundance-based economy. What it looks like, how it's managed, you got me. I don't know. But I think it's between now and that time. And then after that, there won't be landfills anymore. No, you know, nobody will ever throw anything away. They'll all have Mr. Fusion or Mr. Nano Assembler in the basement. And, you know, you'll look forward to getting that junk mail because maybe you need a new pair of pants or something like that. So
I've got a slightly darker vision of the shanty towns.
Okay.
Have you ever had the occasion to read Margaret Atwood's book, Oryx and Crake?
I never have. No.
Okay. She imagines a future not too far away, not too distant, where the only creativity, the only jobs really left are corporations, and they basically set up these compounds, guarded compounds, where people, you know, the privileged few that can contribute to this economy live, you know, very sheltered lives within these compounds. And outside the compounds are the vast plebe lands where, you know, people are exposed to, you know, genetically engineered diseases constantly. It's just a horrible place to live out in the plebe lands. But, you're safe within these compounds, but only a few find that they are able to contribute to where they can be within these compounds. And so it's pretty dark vision of what the shantytown culture could possibly become. And obviously we want to avoid that. So anyway,
that sounds more like traditional shantytowns, only much worse, actually. The corner, I think, that Corey turns with his shantytown is that it's something positive. You're making it's like the guy with the hamburgers, right? You're making the best out of a difficult situation. And in the case of the shantytown in his novel, you actually come up with something in some ways better than what society had to offer before. That's a major leap for shantytowns to make. I don't think that there are a lot of people living in shantytowns today who would feel like they live in those kinds of circumstances. But at the same time, I don't think there's I hope there are at least some, I should put it this way, who don't feel that they're living in the extreme conditions that you described in the Margaret Atwood book, because that sounds very bleak indeed.
Yes. And it gets worse. That's the beginning of the book. Sally asked the question in the chat room, what kind of tech is Atwood postulating? Well, primarily biotech. All kinds of genetic engineering is going on within those compounds. Anyway, go ahead, Phil. I'm sorry.
It's okay. So the interesting thing is, when we look at these portents, these signs, the daily headlines, Victor Davis Hanson's description of what's happening in California. By the way, I disagreed with him on a few points. I should just say, we'll provide the link in the show notes. It's a wonderful essay. I didn't mean to just be bad-mouthing Victor Davis Hanson. I think he raises some really interesting points, and it's, as always, a very well-written piece that he's done. I just interpret the signs differently than he does. He looks at them, and he sees decadence. He sees decay brought about by a hugely wasteful government and a culture that's gotten away from kind of traditional values. I look at it and I say, well, I don't know if any of, you know, there may be some truth to some of that, but what I primarily see happening is the beginning of this transition, potentially. I see automation leading in a couple of different directions. There's no jobs, but also we've got more abundance, so people are, one of the other things he mentions I didn't talk about is they're converting garages into housing, which is very shantytown-like when you think about it. So the question is, how reliably can we take these signs and portents of the future and make a coherent picture of what's going to happen next?
How reliably? The problem with predicting the future is there are so many variables involved. I mean, one variable that we fail to see could come along and upset this whole apple cart that we're trying to build to understand where the future is going. So, I don't know, but it seems I have trouble escaping as I'm seeing pictures of automation and machines stacking pancakes in a pancake factory, which is pretty cool. The video of that is. If you haven't seen it, Phil, you need to. It's kind of fun to watch, actually. But and you see car lines now. I've seen on YouTube pictures of car lines where, as far as you can see, robots are working on cars, and you don't see a single individual, not one person, in the factory as these cars are going through there. It's hard to see something like that and realize how much money they must be saving. And not just money, but also time. People, I can tell you as an employer, the biggest expense of my particular business is payroll. And the second biggest expense would have to be the benefits that I have to pay for as well. So, if you are in any employer and you can find a way to reduce the number of people on your payroll, even if you have is a huge upfront cost associated with the research and development, with buying the necessary equipment, once you've got it in place, the savings would be huge, and you by comparison to your competitors would have a huge advantage, and all of a sudden you're the guy making the cars for everybody because you're able to charge less and people can buy them for less, and so. And you destroy your competition that way. And so
exactly.
I see no good mechanism for keeping this from happening. I guess that's why I find it so compelling and why we keep coming back to it. What can bring the jobs back? I don't see a good mechanism for bringing back the guy that pumps gas in your car.
I don't think that's coming back. I think something
that,
new.
That guy's gone. Yeah.
Something new has to emerge. Either new information based jobs have to emerge. Money based jobs, service based jobs have to emerge. Or people really do take up the gauntlet and start businesses that add value and that make a living for them that way. Those are the two purely private sector ways that that the transition can occur. Failing that, you know, you're into one of these scenarios from Martin Ford or others where they talk about some level of government intervention. And there are, you know, we've talked about what was your idea with an internship program, right? So there are possibilities where it's not a full on welfare state, but the full on welfare state is definitely one of the possibilities on the table that gets us through the transition. And some people are rooting for that. They're cheering for that. Here's my take on interpreting the signs of the times. So the example we traditionally give is the one about the New York City planner who was afraid that the city would be over swamped with manure by the year 1950. But we've told that story lots of times, and someone actually, I don't know if you saw in the comment thread, pulled that one on me last week.
Yeah, I did. I saw that.
I'm like, hey, that's my story, lady, okay, for one thing. But so I'm not going to use that one. I got a different one. I'm going to cite you a statistic, okay? And this is from the year 1920, and I'm looking at a table that records timber growth and removals, and basically it's a bar chart showing billions of cubic feet per year, and the red line indicates removals, and the yellow line indicates net growth. And in the year 1920, we had about 5 billion cubic feet per year of growth, and it looks to me like about 12 billion in removals. So we were in 1920 removing forest at a rate of about 7 billion cubic feet per year over the rate at which we were replenishing it.
Right.
So anyone in 1920, and I'm sure that the years leading up to 1920 had similar bars, probably with the red line getting steeper and steeper and steeper compared to the yellow line. So if one were to look at that in 1920, one would have no choice but to imagine the world 90 years later, 2010, would have to be a United States virtually deforested, virtually without forest at all, because of the alarming rate at which forests were disappearing. Well, let me tell you what happens on the next line on the graph, because that's 1933, and the two lines have become even at that point, right around 8 billion. About 8 billion grew, about 8 billion were removed. The next line is 1952. A lot more removed than in 1933, right out of the Depression, back up over 10 billion. But you know what? By that year, the yellow line had actually nudged above, and nearly 13 million new billion cubic feet of forest had grown. And the difference gets bigger and bigger with each year, 62, 70, 76, and 88. The gap between this very tall yellow line and relatively shorter red line gets greater and greater until you get to 1991, where it was actually significant. It was almost 15 billion that were removed, but nearly 20 billion that were growing. And today, in the U.S., we actually have more acres of forest than we did at the time of the American Revolution. In fact, it's argued that there's more acreage of forest in North America today than there was at the time that Columbus discovered America. So
it could very well be the case. And I find that fascinating. And another thing, I know this because my mother inherited a little bit of timberland in Louisiana, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And she inherited this, I think in the mid-90s or something like that. And so she was, you know, monitoring the timber prices, and they just kept going down and down and down.
Mm-hmm.
And then at some point in the mid-90s, NAFTA opened up Mexican timber to come into our markets. And so then, you know, she says, man, I'm going to just have to give these trees away, you know. So I guess what I'm offering you is the point of view of those who happen to have the acreage, you know, that the trees are
there.
Growing
it is. It's, you know, what I've just described in glowing terms as the reforestation in America has been utterly devastating in terms of your economic return on timber. So
exactly. If you're depending on timber to live on, then you might not be happy with the development of all, you know, the growth of timber. You'd like there to be just a little bit of scarcity at some point, but apparently we have no scarcity when it comes.
Well, that's you want there to be scarcity of whatever the heck it is you're trying to sell. You know?
Exactly.
If you've got some of it, you want it to be scarce so people will, people will pay for it. It only makes sense. That's kind of been the driving force behind our economy all along. It was terrific when we had, his name has slipped my mind, but the guest talking about talking about the future abundant economy with his example of the free printer that he didn't take because it was not worth his while to carry it home, this printer.
Exactly. There's a free printer associated with it. I mean, with his laptop. He bought a laptop, and they were giving away a free printer, but you keep it. I need to walk out of here with just a laptop.
Yeah, not worth the trouble to take it home, as opposed to he had talked about in 1980, the lines of people waiting hours to get on this laser printer at the school that he was attending, and the difference in quality between the two, with the free one that he wouldn't even take being a much much greater. So yeah, that's the whole problem with abundance, is it makes it harder to make a living as the robots take your job. It also makes it harder to make a living if you're trying to sell things that previously have been a bit scarce. But there's plenty of free stuff, plenty of timber, plenty of printers, and so with that in mind, we've got a few more minutes. Let's look at a few other signs of the times and see if we can cautiously say anything about where they're taking us.
Okay, well, I just reading up here, there is a form of fusion, not the Boussard Polywell fusion that we've been following closely, but it's a form of fusion called focus fusion. Eric Lerner's Lawrenceville Plasma Physics Lab is developing a dense plasma focus fusion reactor to use proton boron fuel. And these guys are excited. They just announced this today that the reactions that they are getting out of this machine far exceed their expectations. They're getting more energy out of it at this point than they would have thought, than their theories even suggested they could get. And so they're extremely excited about this. They're saying it looks like we're ready to go on pushing these experiments forward, and you know, the idea being, you know if we can get this to work, you know, if fusion can be made economically viable, and particularly if you can use a reactor that is small and cheap, then you're talking about a future where not only are material goods cheap, but also power is basically free. Not exactly, but close enough. Where
free, like a free computer, is, or like a free printer is free.
Exactly.
It wasn't really free, but
yeah,
it's pretty close.
You had to buy a computer to get the free printer, but, you know, in this case, it's going to be extremely cheap to the point of free. And so I consider that a sign of the times. That's something that's home. And talk about the wild card that can throw all your theories out. If something like that happens, and then overnight the world becomes a much different place beyond anything that anybody really is putting out there, any expectation that any of us really have. So, thought I'd throw that one out.
Well, it's potentially a nice mitigator against some of these. Nobody wants to face a future without a job. Nobody wants to face a future without a paycheck, because that is just scary beyond belief. But let me tell you, if I were to lose my job and I was looking into a future without a paycheck, I would much rather be in a future without a paycheck where there's abundant energy and lots of stuff around than one where there's not, where things are still scarce and where energy is still expensive. Although I should note that the reforestation example I gave was from one of our favorite books that we reference frequently. It's Getting Better All the Time by Stephen Moore and Julian L. Simon. And another one of the charts in that book actually looks at the relative cost of energy over the last 200 years, and it has plummeted. So we're actually looking for what are the breakthroughs that are going to keep the cost of energy going down. And fusion sure sounds like a potential contender, but I think there might be another contender in some of the stories that you were talking about with me before the show.
Well, let's see. See if I can figure out which one you're referring to, Phil. Can you prompt me a little better?
I thought you had one on solar power. No?
Yes. Skip the hard sell. Flexible solar is on the way. This is an article in New Scientist. In this particular solar cell is of no greater efficiency than the standard hard cell, but it takes about 1/100th of the amount of silicon to produce. and it's completely flexible. You can make it in basically a solar cell sticker that you could stick to anything. You know, you put it on the end of a pencil and power some, I don't know, electronic from the end of a pencil. You could put it on the roof of your house, and it could follow the curves of your rooftop or the structure of your shingles or whatever. It's a remarkable vision of where we could go with solar, and it's cheap, and it produces just as much power as the existing solar cells. So I think that's fascinating as well.
Well, just to wind it back just for a moment, one of the things that was interesting about the fusion story is that is a fairly small footprint, easy to deploy method of producing fusion energy. Is that correct?
Exactly. We're talking about a project, not like the billion-dollar projects to bring us fusion in 30 years. We're talking a project where $1 million makes a big in the next step of experimentation.
Yeah. So the kind of deployment of fusion technology that puts it within the price range of a small community or even a business rather than a power generator. You know, I can't imagine the capital investment that you would normally think of to put like a nuclear power plant in place. We're talking about a much, much more efficient, much leaner way of getting to that energy than we would have seen in the past. And now here with this story, it seems to me we're taking the same principle to just a ridiculous level, because here you've got these like flexible solar panels you can just stick anywhere, right? I mean, if you got a surface, might as well start drawing some power from it, right?
Exactly. And it doesn't matter really where the light comes from. It could be artificial light in your house, powering up your iPod, whatever, and wherever you want, you need power, you can apply it to that surface.
Stick some solar cells on and then start collecting.
Yeah.
Very quickly, before we finish, I think there's one more that I really want to get to, and that's the hopefully very soon to be free printer that does something special.
Ah, yes. Printing cells directly onto burn victims. Basically, you get burned instead of a skin graft, where they have to go and remove skin from one part of your body to graft onto another part of your body. The vision here is using a printer to print stem cells directly onto the site of the burn, allowing you to heal without having to go through the agonizing procedure of skin grafts. And that's a huge thing. It's a huge thing. Those who have been through burns have had burns. One of the biggest concerns is infection. And if you could immediately cover the site of the burn with new skin cells that could begin immediately doing what they need to do to heal you up, obviously your chances of infection plummet. They've used these printers on mice and had remarkable results, and they are now moving on to other animal models, other animal testing. Pigs, I think, is the next step, and then they're going to get seek FDA approval to do human trials.
Amazing. So what a thought. The thought of dot matrix printers reapplying skin to burn victims' bodies is just if that doesn't cheer you up, folks. That's the future of abundance. I think we have to look forward to. I said last week, if we want to solve the healthcare problem, make more healthcare. And to me, it looks to me like some folks are working on that.
Excellent.
All right, Stephen, what's our music?
Our music tonight is from Ezra Thomas, and the song is "Mortal Days."
"Mortal Days" by Ezra Thomas. Thanks for getting that together for us, Stephen, and for all these wonderful stories. I wish we had another half hour to talk about them at greater length. Thank you all for being part of our program. Those in the chat room, great chat this evening. Those listening via recording, everyone who listens to Fast Forward Radio, thanks for being with us. We'll be back again next week. Until then, live to see it.
It's a traffic jam, 8 a.m., and I'm singing every song I ever heard. Up in the distance, I see a river flow. Something in me stirs. of another man's plans beneath fluorescent lights. Show.